The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So we have a different emotional flavor or tone each day of this week based on the classical Indian rasa or savors. The Insight teacher, Sylvia Borstein, says that we need three things in our practice: gentleness, precision, and humor. So true. So as we look at these flavors or emotional tones, we can look back that Monday was love and care, which might relate to gentleness. Tuesday was heroism and persistent effort. Maybe the connection there to clarity is less direct, but it is true that we can't see clearly if we don't make some effort to remain undistracted and to look carefully. So we have gentleness, precision, and humor. So we've made it today. Today's flavor is humor. Very helpful to have a sense of humor in our Dharma practice. It's even, you know, it's probably necessary for healing. And Dharma practice, and you know, especially mindfulness practice, helps us to see through things if we stick with it. Teasing things apart or breaking them open or differentiating experience so that we can see different parts of it and not be fooled by the kind of solid seeming picture that we saw at the beginning. I think nearly everyone has this experience, even quite soon after starting practice and just more and more over the years, where we start with something that seems so solid, so bound up in certain ways. And if we just look at it and keep turning it over, encountering it again and again, it kind of breaks apart. We see different pieces. Oh, it's not all one thing. It's got these little parts. So this is this process of seeing through, also called disenchantment in Buddhism, nibbida. That word doesn't always sound appealing, but what it means is this way that we're no longer enchanted or charmed into just seeing something a little bit illusory and often solid, but instead we see pieces of it. We see that it's empty. We see different aspects of it. The spell is no longer cast on us. So disenchantment is a positive term in Buddhist practice. And once we have some experience with seeing through something, then we gain the ability to gently poke fun at some of the mind's tricks and also some of the wider culture's traits. You know, we aren't so attached to things being a certain way. We know that they're differentiated. We know also that they're often created or constructed to be a certain way because we've seen the process in the mind of constructing them. Wow, my mind just produced that anger or that something else. So it's very freeing to see that, to see that things are not so solid, they shift and change. A lot of it we're making up. And so then we can smile at the antics of the mind, at least sometimes. This poor, silly mind. Do you feel that sometimes? So, you know, just as a simple example, we don't control what thought will arrive next. Who knows what the mind's going to toss up next? Gill tells a story of walking. One time he was walking to IMC from his house, and he just happened to walk by a pickup truck that had a big tarp over the back of it. Not such an uncommon sight. But his mind produced the thought, I wonder if there's a body under that tarp. And he thought, what? Where did that come from? Who knows? You know, who knows why the mind said that? So we have, I think, numerous instances of this during the day where the mind produces some thought based on sensory input. We don't know where that came from, but it's kind of amusing if we're open to the amusing side of it. And this can even extend, you know, into areas that we would consider more serious, the spiritual realm or religious culture. I'm thinking now about the Dalai Lama, who, of course, has a very honored position. And so the result is that when he goes to teach somewhere, there's a lot of pomp and beautiful things and, you know, high up seats and all of this. And sometimes you can see him laughing at that, right? He takes it lightly, but in a skillful way, you know. He very much takes seriously his role as the Bodhisattva of compassion for our world. But he's not caught up in that, in a sense. And there's a certain way that the lightness contributes to his gentleness, his healing, his love. I remember him watching him ascend up to a high teaching seat on something he was going to teach. And of course, it was very well padded, right? And so he got up there and he realized, oh, this is soft, what they put up here for me. And he kind of bounced on it for a moment, like a child might bounce on a bed. And you could see he was just amused and delighted right there in the middle of giving, you know, setting up for a serious teaching. So, you know, that's that kind of skillful lightness comes from seeing the emptiness of the world, seeing through the constructions of what we're making and creating. So there's a way that, you know, we can develop that skill also. And I think it's actually important for our practice to have that side. There's a prayer in the Vajrayana practice where one asks, give me energy to see through life's illusions. It's a nice wish. And there's humor in the suttas also. There's a wonderful story in a text called the Udana about a monk named Nanda. And it seems that Nanda was discontent with the monastic life. And he told his comrades that he was planning to disrobe. And so they went and told the Buddha, who summoned Nanda. And the Buddha asked him why he was discontent. And he talked about a woman. He said, on departing from home, a Sakin woman, the loveliest in the land, with her hair half combed, looked up at me and said, may you return soon, master. And he was so smitten with her that he just couldn't be satisfied with the monastic life. So the Buddha doesn't try to reply to this directly. Instead, he grabs Nanda by the arm and he transports him up to one of the heaven realms. And there, Nanda sees Sakka, the ruler of the devas, being attended upon by, the text says, 500 pink-footed nymphs. Apparently, this is a reference, by the way, to a practice, a beautification practice in ancient India where women would rouge their feet. We think rouge is just for the face, but they put it on their feet. So 500 pink-footed nymphs. And the Buddha asks Nanda, which is lovelier, these nymphs or the Sakin woman that he couldn't get over? And he says, oh, the nymphs. And so the Buddha promises Nanda 500 pink-footed nymphs if he will stay as a monk living the holy life. And he agrees. So, of course, the other monks hear about this and they tease him incessantly. And they say, the venerable Nanda is living the holy life for the sake of nymphs. And he becomes very embarrassed and ashamed by this. And that is exactly what prompts him to go practice rigorously, the result of which is that he gains arahantship, you know, enlightenment. So at that point, he has a different view of the world. He has seen through all the constructions and all the antics of his mind. And he, as an Arahant, he goes back to the Buddha and he says, about those 500 nymphs, never mind. So it's a great story. I think it's clear to me, at least, that the compilers of the Pali Canon had some sense of humor. So, there are more subtle indications of humor also. There's a sutta where the Buddha kind of jokes with the monks, says to them a little bit, you can almost hear the kind of the tone. He says, you may well acquire that possession that is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and that might endure as long as eternity. But do you see any such possession? And the monks all say, no, venerable sir. And so he praises them, saying, that's true, I don't see any such possession either. And then he goes on and says, you may well cling to that doctrine of self that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who clings to it. But do you see any such doctrine of self? No, venerable sir. And he agrees. So he, he seems to be gently teasing them. And I think as we get more familiar with the suttas, we start to see places where there is subtle humor or irony or poking fun, more of them than we might think. So, how can we use this flavor of humor, lightness, amusement in our practice? We've already noted some, but I'd like to add one more angle. So if there's something that we can't laugh about, most likely there is some identification there, some kind of clinging, some kind of identity, usually. So we can use this negative approach, what we don't laugh about, to highlight where we're clinging. And then maybe we can try to bring some lightness to it. What we don't find funny reveals where our identity is invested. It's not that everything should be humorous, but if we can't find any lightness in some area, it's worth investigating to see if there's some sticking point there. And just as we heard in the sutta quote a moment ago, the Buddha points out that the identification is a form of suffering. You might find that self you can cling to that won't bring sorrow, but do you see such a self? No. Ajahn Buddhadasa was a boxer before he became a monk. And even when he was a well-known teacher, he retained some of that kind of a belligerent air sometimes that could come across as gruff or blunt to people. And sometimes people took offense at him because they thought that a spiritual teacher should be kind and gentle in a particular way. And if anyone challenged his demeanor, Ajahn Buddhadasa would roar with laughter and he would say, oh, that's just my personality. So, there's a way that humor has an important place in our practice in the right way, in a skillful way. It can be done unskillfully also, but it's a key component of Dharma practice. And especially when we start seeing clearly into all the strange habits that our mind has accumulated, lightness really helps. So that is our flavor for today. And I hope you might find some ways in your day today to look with lightness or smile at something that that you could have gotten caught up in. Give it a try. All right. Be well.